Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Boy in the Locked Room by K.M. Avery. Narrated by Daniel Henning. Chapter 1. My name is Ward Campion, and I talk to the dead. I'm a medium, given the so-called gift of being able to see and speak to spirits as a fun and exciting consequence of a severe arcanavirus infection about 7 years ago. The arcanavirus pandemic has been raging for just under 30 years, with no sign of abating and no cure, and it has left 7% of its victims, like me, with new arcane abilities. Maybe seeing dead people, or prognosticating the future, or being able to see the past by touching an object, or reading the mind or emotions of someone just by taking their hand. Another 6% ended up with fur, or fangs, or pointy ears, or some combination thereof. Elves, orcs, vampires, shifters, ghouls, and fauns. A regular mythological pantheon. It certainly made things a lot more interesting when you sometimes ended up with a faun as your local librarian or a ghoul as your car mechanic. I occasionally had a hard time understanding Rusty, since ghouls had a lot of facial laxity, but he was a nice enough guy, if a little funny smelling. Rusty was lucky, though. A lot of arcanids, nids for short, weren't able to find jobs, or at least not well-paying ones. Because human beings are nothing, if not assholes, so they shun anyone and everyone who doesn't fit within a spectrum of normal. And nids definitely did not. Those of us who at least looked the same, more or less, as when we got sick were still generally employable, presuming we hadn't been driven insane by whatever so-called ability we woke up with. As for me, I periodically consult for the police on homicides, and I also take on private clients who have questions for their loved ones who've passed on, or need help finding valuables or legal documents. Sometimes they're looking to talk to long-dead ancestors, and that usually involves the assistance of Dr. Mason Manning, historian and orc, and also my boyfriend. I know people say you're not supposed to work with your significant other, but working together is how we met in the first place. I was hired to figure out what was going on in an old plantation house that was trapping the spirits of everyone unfortunate enough to die there. I needed to know the history of the house, and he was a historian, who also happened to be working as a gardener at the time. It's a long story. The point is, we'd figured it out. Well, Mason had figured it out. My best friend Beck and I just barely managed to break the spell and open the gateway for the dead to pass beyond. Most of them, anyway. Sylvia, otherwise known as Lady Sylvia Randolph, decided that she liked us. So now it's me, my cat, my orc boyfriend, his dog, and a century-plus dead ghost who likes to call me Nancy. I used to just work under my own name, Edward Campion, medium. But now that I've tripled, or two and a halved, I guess, my staff, we needed a new name. Mason suggested the one that stuck. Beyond the Veil Investigations. We were doing terribly. And it was my fault. Well, okay. It was technically the fault of the evil, sadistic ghost who tried to claw my spine out and put me in a fucking wheelchair 3 months ago, but I was the one who was no longer capable of doing basic things like getting into a car by myself, much less drive to a gig. And Mason was still working for his twin sister, Kydra, as a gardener, so I couldn't take any day gigs, or really anything too late at night if he had to get up in the morning, because then I felt terrible that he had to go do heavy manual labor on like 3 hours or less of sleep. Added to our scheduling difficulties was the fact that I'd just gotten absolutely slammed with more medical bills, see above about the asshole ghost trying to rip out my spine, and things were looking decidedly grim. I'd even recently started looking at job postings for remote IT work. And I hated working IT, even if that's what my degree was actually in. You know how it goes. You make choices based on what is marketable at the time, ignoring that little voice in your head asking if you really want to do that. Take it from me. You don't. But then you've got the skills for a job that you don't like and nothing else, and you end up despairing over the fact that you've set yourself up for a lifetime of drudgery and disappointment and shitty job ads. In fact, I was staring at one such post right now, trying to decide if it was worth dusting off my resume and adding in the last 5 years of managing my own website to try to get more than a couple of hundred a month coming in. Because while Mason could support himself, I knew he probably couldn't actually afford to keep feeding both of us, and Peveril and Alma, my cat and his deaf dog, even if his sister was giving him extra work to help out. So I'd also started thinking about moving back in with my Auntie Pearl. Not because I didn't want to keep living with Mason, because I really, really did, but because I was starting to feel like I was demanding all of his time, energy, and money, and not putting back into this relationship what I was taking. Pearl was the closest thing I had to a parent left, so she kind of had to let me move back in if I begged. I honestly probably wouldn't even have to beg. I would have to explain to her why I was moving out of my boyfriend's house, and I would have to explain to Mason that I was moving out of his house, and neither of those conversations would go well at all. So, I didn't want to do that either. This should tell you just how shitty things were. I was almost 34 years old, about 30 grand in medical debt, and contemplating giving up my arcane career and moving back in with my aunt because it was a struggle to put on my own pants in the morning. When I'd gone in last week for an MRI on my spine, the doctor had suggested that I might want to consider antidepressants as a means of coping with the fact that I was probably never going to walk again, since there was no sign of spinal healing. Now, I'm not above taking meds when I need them. I already take a good handful on a daily basis, but I'm pretty sure that my problems right now are situational rather than biochemical. That, and I didn't have the money to go to the psychiatrist I'd need to see for a prescription. Yesterday, I told Mason to sell my Highlander. It was 6 years old and well used, so it wasn't going to bring in a lot, but it was something, and I sure as shit wasn't going to be driving it, apparently, ever again. No point in having it sitting there eating insurance and tax money. I sighed heavily, staring listlessly at my email, waiting for anything at all to come in. Anything. I looked up at the clock on the shelf, an antique desk clock that had belonged to Mason's grandfather, Dom, who, although dead, was still a constant presence in the family. Mason's gran, Mariana, was a bruja, or witch, from the Dominican Republic, who had come to Virginia and raised Mason from the time he was 8, because he was also a witch. In the past 4 months, Mason had started casting again after years of essentially avoiding magic. He was a healer, and I knew that he'd been trying to heal me, although clearly that hadn't been helping my spine, at least. That said, his magic had definitely helped ease the persistent ache in my lower back and the muscle pains in my shoulders from having to suddenly use my arms as my primary means of mobility. Mason's casting meant I could take fewer pain meds, and that was a definite bonus, so I wasn't about to complain. But Mason had been almost as upset as I was when the doctor told us there was no sign of healing, and I'd probably never regain movement in my legs. Mason had left this morning around 7, and I'd pretended to still be asleep, although I'm pretty sure he can tell. But he just softly kissed my temple before he went, making sure the blanket was up over my shoulders. Because that's the kind of amazing boyfriend he is that I completely don't deserve. I spent the day trying to figure out just how desperate I was for work. And now it was almost 6, and Mason wasn't home yet. He'd been working longer and later, supposedly because Kydra needed the help in doing prep work for when the spring planting season started. I was pretty sure she was just making him move heavy things from one side of a storage space to the other. I was also pretty sure that Mason, who was brilliant, knew it. And that made me feel worse. When we'd first met, Mason had gotten angry with me because he thought I was treating him as a charity case. I hadn't been. But it was pretty damn clear that if either of us was a charity case, it was absolutely me. At the time, I hadn't understood why he was so mad. I got it now. And to make things worse, I actually needed the help, so I couldn't stand on pride and refuse it. And neither could he, as long as I was relying on him to feed and house me. At least I could walk the dog before he got home. Alma was lying curled up on her doggy bed, having learned pretty quickly that I posed a hazard to her paws, watching me. I gestured for her to come over as I rolled up to the door, grabbing her leash off the small table next to it. Alma was deaf, so we had to communicate with her using sign language. I was getting the hang of it, and I'd taken her out a handful of times by myself before, although not usually in the dark. It was February, so it was pretty much black by 6 these days. The neighborhood was quiet enough that I'd been fine with Alma going down the street. The sidewalks were too broken up by tree roots and uneven cracks for me to be able to get over them. I pulled on my coat and fuzzy boots, since even if I couldn't use my legs, I could still feel them, and my feet get as cold as anybody else's in winter. Colder, probably, since I can't so much as wiggle my toes to keep them warm. I hooked Alma's leash to her harness and my chair before rolling my way out to the front door and down the plywood ramp Mason had installed not long after Thanksgiving when I'd moved in with him. We made our 3-block circuit quick, it was nearly freezing, and got back before 6:30. I fed her, then left her to eat her dinner. Still, no Mason. I tried to tell myself to stop worrying, since Mason is 6'7 and absolutely jacked, but I couldn't help it. In the course of our first investigation, he'd been handcuffed and arrested by the police in 2 separate incidents, and I was becoming paranoid that one of these days he just wouldn't come home because somebody decided he was a dangerous monster and would lock him up, or, God forbid, put a bullet in him. I'd give him until 8 before I called his sister. In the meantime, I decided I could at least attempt to make a sad dinner. Bread, cheese, lettuce, tomato, onion, condiments, sandwiches, and chips were about all I could manage these days, since I couldn't actually reach most of the pots and pans. I could get at the countertop and the lower cupboards for things like cutting boards, mixing bowls, and plates. Mason had put in a flip-up counter on one wall so that I could roll under it to do prep or eat without having to twist sideways. There was also an entire lower cupboard with dishes, so I didn't always have to ask Mason if I wanted food or a drink. Mason has the patience of a fucking saint. For the record, I do not. It was a little after 7 when he finally came in through the back door, and I heard a heavy sigh as the door closed. I chewed on my lower lip, feeling emotion pushing against the back of my throat because it was my fault he was so tired and overworked. Tall, muscular, and a dusky olive green, he walked into the kitchen from the back mudroom, pausing when he saw my offering of sandwiches and the accompanying bowl of potato chips. Although there were stress lines on his forehead and around his mouth, they smoothed a little as he offered me the twist of his lips around his protruding lower canines that was his tired smile.
"Hey, you made me dinner."
Only Mason would be kind enough to call this making him dinner. The smile I gave him back was weak. "If you want to call it dinner."
"Can I eat it?"
he asked, teasingly, crossing the kitchen in his socks to bend down and press a kiss to my forehead. "Yeah." I wasn't a great cook, but I wasn't so terrible that I would wreck sandwiches.
Then it's dinner.
He ran his fingers through my curls.
Thank you.
I already walked Alma, I told him, and the smile got a little bigger.
Then thank you for that, too.
He picked up both plates and carried them into the living room, setting them on the card table that had taken up more or less permanent residence beside the couch. I put the bowl of chips in my lap and followed. Reaching the couch, I put the bowl on the table, then flipped the lock on the chair so I could push myself up with one hand to scoot my butt to the couch. Mason watched from where he was crouching, petting Alma on her bed, and I could see his fingers twitch as he suppressed the urge to do it for me, or offer to help. Like I said, patience of a fucking saint. When I'd first moved in, I hadn't yet gotten the hang of getting myself in and out of the damn chair, and he'd do it for me, lifting me from chair to bed to couch to car. He still had to help me with the car, since his truck was a good deal higher than the couch or even the bed. He'd also replaced the bulky high vanity in the master bathroom for me, which in hindsight seemed like an expense that wasn't worth going to, but I did appreciate being able to use the bathroom sink instead of the guest bathtub to brush my teeth, shave, and wash my face. In fact, he'd accommodated himself to me and my new requirements without a single complaint, despite the fact that he was 6'7" and now had to basically crouch to use his own bathroom sink. Mason joined me on the couch, then reached over and ran the backs of his fingers across my cheek.
"Penny?"
he asked, abbreviating the old phrase, "a penny for your thoughts." I shook my head, not wanting to get into it. Again. I won't call it an argument between us because there was no arguing. He seemed to be totally fine with changing his house, his habits, and his life to make space for me, and I was the one who was upset about it, even though it was me who benefited. He always just looked at me in utter confusion whenever I demanded to know why he wasn't angry at the fact that I'd upended his life. Mason sighed.
"Can I hold you?"
he asked, his voice softer than usual. I looked up, reading stress in the inhuman lines of his face, the set of his slightly protruding lower jaw, his lips tight across the exposed lower canines. I nodded, putting a chip back on my plate and pushing myself closer. I felt him shift, making room for me between his legs before he reached out and pulled me until I was nestled into him, my back against his chest. He was warm. Mason was always warm. And he let out another sigh as he rested his cheek against my dark curls. "What's wrong?" I asked, even though I was pretty sure I knew the problem here was me. Mason drew in a long breath through my hair.
"How can I help?"
he asked instead. Yeah. I was the problem. Suddenly, no longer hungry, I stared down at my hands resting in my lap.
"Ward, please."
I hated the pain I could hear in his voice, and I felt tears slipping from my eyes, even though I tried to glare them into submission. I swallowed, trying to steady my voice. "You do help," I told him, although I couldn't make myself meet his beautiful sunburst eyes, their dark irises studded with flecks of gold. "I just hate being helpless." One arm pulled me closer.
"I know. I'm sorry."
I shook my head. "You shouldn't be. You're at least doing something. I'm just fucking stuck." I huffed out a breath. "I can't take gigs that I can't get to, and I'm not going to constantly ask you and Pearl to drive me places." Mason was quiet for a moment.
"How many have you turned down in the last month?"
he asked. It was my turn to sigh. 6. I'd gotten requests for 8, One was a low-income family that I'd barely charged. The other had brought in a few grand, but it had been a simple check of some wording in a will, so it wasn't much.
And how much would that have brought in?
It's hard to say.
Ward?
I sighed again. Probably 8,000 or 9,000? He hummed softly.
And you didn't take them because I was working at the time?
I nodded.
Then I think I should stop working for Kydra,
he said, and I turned sharply. What? Mason shrugged.
It's more than I make. If we really want Beyond the Veil to work, I think I should put my time here. You won't have to turn down gigs because they won't conflict with my work. They'll be my work.
I stared at him. But...
It's February. Kai will have time to hire new hands before she needs to start getting into the thick of spring planting season, and we never meant this to be permanent anyway. I just didn't care enough when I lost my job at the university to really try. Now I have a reason to try.
I felt myself tearing up again. I've done a lot of crying in the last 6 months or so, and a lot of it was because Mason is just so damn sweet, I can't help it. He pulled me closer, pressing a kiss to my temple.
What do you think?
What if it doesn't work? I asked.
What if it does?
He countered. Mason is the optimist in our relationship. You'd think that someone who regularly has to deal with people assuming the worst of him would be a bit more jaded, but not Mason. That's not to say he's oblivious to the way humanity works. He's very realistic. But he also has a lot more confidence in things working out eventually than I do. On the table beside the couch, my work email chimed. I turned my head and narrowed my eyes at my witchy boyfriend. Did you know about that? A smile once more twisting his lips, he shook his head. I briefly contemplated ignoring it, but curiosity, and a little desperation, got the better of me, and I scooted myself down the couch until I could reach the computer. Then I let out a squeak as Mason's big hands grabbed my hips and pulled me back. He nestled his chin against my head as I opened the laptop. The request was pretty standard, a woman asking about finding closure by speaking to her deceased father. What she didn't do was give me his name. This was a thing. People assumed that because I could talk to the dead, that I was also psychic, even though that is very much not how it works. I can see and talk to dead people. I can summon them if I need to from beyond the veil, hence the name of our little business. And if things get really hairy, I can send them back, banish them. And when shit really hits the fan, I apparently can destroy them by tearing them apart metaphysically, although I've only done that once, and it pretty much killed me too. Fortunately for me, Mason had been there to pull me back. But none of that means that I have the ability to actually read minds or figure out people's names without doing research. Research is what I have Mason for.
So I guess I'm doing a little bit of digging then?
He asked, reading the email over my shoulder. You mind?
Not at all.
I sent an email back, replying that I would be happy to negotiate a contract and date for the seance. Then Mason closed the computer and set it on the floor.
Okay, dinner now,
he reminded me, reaching out and putting my plate in my lap. With his other hand, he grabbed one of the sandwiches on his plate and took a bite.
What are we on?
The Frighteners. Mason was slowly introducing me to a variety of ghost movies, alternating between horror and ridiculous, cheesy comedies. We had a running list. We also had a tradition of not making it through movies, either because we got easily distracted or because one or both of us fell asleep. It usually took 2 or 3 tries to actually watch them from beginning to end. This time, it was Mason whose breath slowed and evened out, barely 30 minutes in. I didn't want to wake him, and I certainly didn't have the ability, like he did with me, to pick him up and carry him to bed, so instead, I snuggled into his warm body and let unconsciousness take me too. Chapter 2. The blonde boy was standing on the edge of the river, staring into the water, his hand gripping what looked like a switchblade. I wondered if he intended to use it on me or on whatever it was he was staring at.
"You haven't helped me," he accused, his voice sounding both angry and hurt.
"I don't know how," I replied. "And I don't know where you are." He turned to look at me, and I could see that there were tears on his cheeks. He frowned, aging as I watched from about 10 to about 20.
"You haven't helped me," he repeated.
"I still can if you'll tell me how." He blinked slowly, those black eyes strangely intense.
"They keep me in a room," he said, his voice tense. "I don't like it here. I don't want to be here. I want to go outside."
He turned back to the river.
"Do you know where you are?"
I asked him.
"No."
That was not helpful.
"What do you know?" "They don't let me go outside."
As he spoke, he de-aged, shrinking back into boyhood.
"I want to go outside."
"Do you know who they are?"
"Doctors, nurses, orderlies."
He held up the knife, turning his gaze from the glinting water to the glinting blade.
"I hate them."
My heart pounded in my chest. He was a patient somewhere. If he really was in his 20s, that would mean he'd been there for a while, if his sometimes youthful appearance was any indication. It had to be an institution.
"Why did they put you in there?"
I asked, and even in my dream, I could tell that I sounded nervous. Those black eyes turned back to me.
"Because I killed someone."
I jerked awake, not afraid, but with my heart pounding in my chest as I pushed myself up on one elbow. A big, warm hand came to rest on my hip.
"Ward?"
Mason's voice was sleepy. "Another dream about rain," I answered. It was still dark, but the clock said it was almost 7. I was a late-night person, but Mason was usually awake by now. He must have been exhausted, which made me feel guilty about being the cause.
"Anything new?"
Clarity was coming into his voice as he woke up. "Yeah," I answered, settling back. The bed shifted as Mason snuggled closer. I told him about what Rain had said and my guess that he was in an institution. Then I told him about the last bit, where Rain said he'd killed someone. Mason hummed, a sound that indicated he was thinking, although there was an edge to it that I could recognize as concern. Not to say that I wasn't concerned, given the fact that I'd promised to help someone who had killed somebody, or who said they did anyway, and who might be in a mental institution.
"Did he say why he killed someone?"
"Does it matter?"
"Self-defense is usually justifiable, as opposed to murder."
"Good point. No, I don't know why he did it. I woke up." "I'll ask him next time." Mason hummed again.
"It does give us something more to go on."
"Residential institutions?"
"Mm-hmm."
"But we have no idea where. He could literally be anywhere."
"I don't think so."
I studied Mason's face in the slowly lightening gloom as the sun began creeping over the horizon.
He was aware of Preston Fitzwilliam, which suggests that he's geographically close enough to be aware of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?